Well, we come this evening to the second part of the book of Daniel. Five miraculous visions. Part that gets a little tougher as far as understanding exactly what all is meant by some of the symbolism and so forth. But before we actually start looking, you know, we're probably not all going to agree exactly on some of the symbolism. You might not agree with everything that I conclude from these chapters as far as exactly what some of these symbols mean and so forth, and that's okay. The good thing is I don't think we have to understand every detail of some of the symbolism that's here to go to heaven. But it is part of having a broader knowledge of God's Word. But there are some things we probably won't agree on or might not agree on. Much of the symbolism is used fairly commonly among the prophetic books. As you go to Jeremiah's writing and Ezekiel and Isaiah and the minor prophets, you'll find many similar things. We'll refer to some of those as we go through. But as I noted on the back of the bulletin where I have my notes there, don't get too caught up in the symbolism or so caught up in the symbolism and trying to understand exactly what every minute detail of symbolism is to where we miss the bigger picture, to where we miss the main message that's here. And part of the reason that I had Alan read the verses that he just read, which are actually a little further than where we're going to get tonight, is that's really the focus. All of this talk about kingdoms and so forth, it's all talking about and focused upon that eternal kingdom. Remember in the dream in chapter 2, we have the four kingdoms, but during that fourth kingdom, that everlasting kingdom is going to be established. One that's going to last forever. All these earthly kingdoms are going to have their heydays, and they're going to come to a time that they cease to exist. But that everlasting kingdom, the Ancient of Days that Alan just read about, giving that kingdom over to one as the Son of Man, that's the focus. And that eternal kingdom will last forever. And we're a part of that eternal kingdom, a kingdom that we don't have to worry about foreign armies coming in, invading, taking away from us. Because it's God's kingdom. It's victorious. It's the one that will last forever. And so as we go through all of these visions, if you don't get anything out of the symbolism and so forth, keep that message in mind. Because that's really what Daniel's trying to tell us. And certainly those are words of encouragement to people in Daniel's time and subsequently on through the Old Testament, as many of them live in bondage. They're going to be words of encouragement in the times of the Roman Empire, as John is writing, in times of persecution, talking about some of these same things in the book of Revelation. And so don't allow the symbolism to cause you to miss the message. There's no chronological order that's adhered to through these last visions, chapter 7 through 12. And so it's not intended to be a continuation of chapters 1 through 6. We'll be able to go back and place several of these in their proper place in between those preceding chapters. But it's not a continuation of that. So the first one we see, chapter 7, and we are going to divide this into a couple of lessons. The four beasts described and interpreted. We're only going to look at the first 8 verses this evening, but we're going to look at them in some detail, and we'll be able to go on through the remaining verses, Lord willing, fairly quickly next week. The first section, the one we'll spend all of our time in this evening, the vision, the interpretation, and the description of the things that Daniel is seeing. So first of all, verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. When he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven were stirring up the great sea. And so we get first of all, a time stamp, you might say, the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Well, that would place it between chapters 4 and 5 chronologically. Remember in chapter 4 we had the Nebuchadnezzar as he goes insane and is out grazing with the cattle and the great humiliation and humbleness that comes from that. In chapter 5 we have the very last day of Belshazzar's reign and the handwriting on the wall. And so this would place it in between those two chapters. The exact year, we're not sure. If you remember when we talked about in chapter 5, Nabonidus was actually the reigning king. Belshazzar was a co-regent along with him. Nabonidus reigned from 556 to 539 B.C. But what we don't know is for sure when he appointed Belshazzar as the co-regent with him. If he did that at the very beginning of his reign, then that would place this in about 556, 555 B.C. If he did it sometime later, which is probably more the case, whenever he decided to go off on a foreign campaign, then we don't know exactly when that would be. But sometime during that reign, certainly, 556 down toward into the 540s even possibly. But again, Daniel's dream very closely parallels the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had in chapter 2. He saw the great image, and the interpretation of that was the various kingdoms that those parts of that image represented. Daniel sees a great wind, the four winds of heaven, he says. Four is a very significant number when we come to apocalyptic literature. It's the number of man. And as you read through Daniel and Revelation, many of these other prophetic books, numbers are very important. We don't place near the emphasis on numbers that they did. But four was the number of man. Three is the number of God. And if you put four and seven, man's number and God's number together, then you had seven. Four and three together, you had seven, which is considered the perfect number. But four was the number of man, a very significant number. These winds are controlled by God. It says they're winds of heaven. And so these are winds that are being controlled by Him. The four winds are often used in Scripture to indicate God's destructiveness and His controlling force of the world. Jeremiah, on several occasions, uses the wind that way. But it says the wind stirred up the great sea. Well, the term great sea, usually as it's used in Scripture in a literal way, is usually referring to the Mediterranean Sea, the sea that most of the biblical events took place around. But here I believe it's symbolic, talking about the sea of humanity. The sea of people, of who people are. In Revelation 17, verse 15, it says, And the angel said to me, The waters that you saw, where the prostitute is seated, are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. So he's talking there in Revelation very clearly, because he tells us so, that these waters are the waters or seas of humanity. They're made up of peoples and multitudes, nations, languages. I think he's using it the same way here in the book of Daniel. And so the symbolism is that it's a world of nations in a turbulent state, indicating invading armies and upheaval of nations and empires. It's turbulent times. Nations overthrowing other nations, and world empires building up, soon to be taken down by other world empires and so forth. Then we have the four beasts, verse 3. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. And so they arise out of the sea, out of the sea of humanity. And so these are of human in origin. But they don't arise simultaneously. They arise one after the other. their diversity from one another is in worth. They have a couple of things in common. They arise, each of them arises from the sea, from the sea of humanity, and so they're a product of man's work. They're empires that are built by men, and each one is great. Now, these are going to be the empires that are represented are going to be great empires. Worldwide, the world is known at that time empires. Very powerful in their extent. They each represent a kingdom of human origin, of human nature. Again, going back to Daniel chapter 2, verse 31, it says, "You saw," as Daniel begins to interpret this dream for Nebuchadnezzar, he says, "You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening." And then he went on to describe the different parts of that image and what those different parts stood for. In Revelation 13, verse 1, John says, "I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads with 7 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads." So we'll talk more about Revelation 13 in a few moments. But each of these beasts is described as we go through verses 4 through 8. The first was like a lion. Verse 4. "The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. As I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it." And so we have a beast that Daniel is trying to describe these in some way that we can understand. And so he's trying to liken them to some type of an animal that we can get an image of in our head. He doesn't say this is a lion. He says it's like a lion. But we very quickly see that it's not like any lion that we know anything about, because it has eagle's wings. I've seen pictures and statues and so forth of lions with wings, but I've never seen a real lion with wings. They don't exist. Well, this beast is going to correspond with the head of gold in chapter 2. And that, of course, was the Babylonian Empire. And this symbol is especially appropriate to the Babylonian Empire because archaeologists that have done digs in that part of the world, researching that ancient Babylonian Empire, have unearthed many statues of lions with wings. It was evidently something that was very prominent in their society as a symbol. And so he's using a symbol, evidently, that they were familiar with. One that they used for themselves, even, perhaps. But both the empire and Nebuchadnezzar as an individual are compared to a lion as well as to an eagle in many places in the Old Testament. Again, you look at the other prophetic books, Jeremiah on several occasions uses the lion and or the eagle to talk about the Babylonian Empire, both in the book of Jeremiah and in the books of Lamentation. Habakkuk, Ezekiel also use those symbols. And so you have the lion, who is considered the king of the beast, and the eagle, who's considered the king of the birds. Those very well correspond with gold, which is the king of metals, that's used there in chapter 2 to represent Nebuchadnezzar and his Babylonian kingdom. But then we see that this beast's wings are plucked. As Daniel is watching, these eagle's wings are plucked from it. Well, that would deprive it of its power of flight. That would deprive it of its ability to fly over the earth and to conquer the earth. It would deprive it of its power even to hover over its own worldwide empire ruling over it. And so its power would become diminished as these wings are plucked from it. And then he says that it's raised up on 2 feet like a man. And a man's mind is given to it. The beast's nature was changed to that of a man, both inwardly as a man's mind or a man's heart. Some of your versions will say heart. We know that the biblical heart is the mind. That's given to it. And outwardly, it stands up on its back feet, on 2 feet, as a man would stand. Well, we have a humanizing process then that's taking place. And as we look at that history of that Babylonian Empire, at the beginning they were a very heathenistic, very cruel, very pagan empire, known for their ruthlessness. And so they were very much like animals in the way that they acted. But we've seen even in this book, as we've seen Daniel and these others come in and their influence on Nebuchadnezzar, haven't we? As they continued to live a godly life and present Jehovah to Nebuchadnezzar. And he became more and more man-like. The empire became more and more man-like and had those human qualities. And then we saw again in chapter 4 the humiliation of Nebuchadnezzar. As he's given the mind of a beast, chapter 4 verse 13, and he's out grazing in the pasture with the cattle, and he's humbled. And what was his reaction whenever his mind came back to him? He then acknowledged the true God of Jehovah, didn't he? Not just as a God among the polytheistic myriad of gods that was out there, but at that time he seems to be acknowledging him as the God. And so we have a humanizing effect from going from a very pagan nation to one that is much more gentle, much more human in nature. The king, Nebuchadnezzar, and the kingdom of Babylon are used interchangeably. They're viewed identically. Same thing back in chapter 2, verse 38. Well, then we come to another kingdom. Verse 5, and behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, arise, devour much flesh. Now the word another there distinguishes it from the lion. This is another. That one's, we're now moved from that lion, the one like a lion, to now one that's like a bear. And second denotes the order. We had the first beast, now we have the second beast. And this one, again, it's not a bear, but it's like a bear. It's enough like a bear that's what we can use to comprehend it in some way. Well, the second part of Nebuchadnezzar's dream was a breast of silver representing the Medo-Persian Empire. Daniel's dream here in chapter 7 represents that Medo-Persian Empire is like a bear. But we have a description of it and the action that it has. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was commanded to arise, devour much flesh. Well, this Medo-Persian Empire, they're going to come in and take over being the world power from that Babylonian Empire. Again, we saw that in chapter 5, because the very night that the handwriting was on the wall and the things we read about there in chapter 5, Belshazzar was killed and the Medes and the Persians took over. Actually took the city of Babylon without even a battle. But they went out, they marched out, and they devoured other nations before them. That's told in other prophecies. Isaiah chapter 13, verses 17 and 18. Isaiah writes, behold, I'm stirring up the Medes against them. Talking about the Babylonians. I'm stirring up the Medes against them, who has no regard for silver and does not delight in gold. Their bows will slaughter the young men. They will have no mercy on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes will not pity children. These are men that are out devouring flesh. They're marching forth, conquering. whoever's before them, man, woman, or child, it doesn't matter. And so they're a very ruthless people. But notice who's in control. There in Isaiah, he says, "Behold, I am stirring up the Medes against them." God's in control of this whole process. That's what he's showing us with that image in chapter 2, with the things we see here in chapter 7. Again, in Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 11, Jeremiah writes, "Sharpen the arrows, take up the shields. The Lord has stirred up the spirit of the kings of the Medes, because his purpose concerning Babylon is to destroy it. And for that is the vengeance of the Lord, the vengeance for his temple." What had they done? They had destroyed his temple, hadn't they? They had served as his agents of vengeance against Israel, or against Judah, the southern kingdom. But they had destroyed his temple. He's going to now destroy them. Verse 28 of that same chapter, Jeremiah writes, "Prepare the nations for war against her, the kings of the Medes, with their governors and deputies in every land under their dominion." And so again, these things are happening at God's command. God is bringing the Medes against the Babylonians. Well, this kingdom is going to be treated more fully as we come to chapter 8. We'll see more details. But the bear, as we look at the details we have here, the bear is inferior to the lion. Just as in that image in chapter 2, silver is inferior to gold. This kingdom is not going to be as great as the kingdom of the Babylonians that was before it. Again, as we look at prophetic literature, the Old Testament literature, we see the bear and the lion oftentimes used. In the book of Proverbs, and Isaiah, and Lamentation, Hosea, Amos, 1 Samuel. And so these are symbols that are often seen. The bear is raised up on one side. Or this one like a bear, this beast like a bear. He's raised up on one side. As you read different commentaries, there's a lot of ideas there, but I think it's simply showing that he's marching forth. It goes with the command to arise and devour. He's lifted up, about to take a step, about to begin that process of going out and conquering. Arise and devour much flesh. We have also represented maybe in that the idea of this double-sided nature of this kingdom. That it is a kingdom really made up of two empires, of two peoples, the Medes and the Persians. We'll see that again when we come to chapter 8, verse 3, where he says, "I raised my eyes and saw, behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last." That ram's the same Medo-Persian Empire. He has those two horns representing those two groups of people. One's higher than the other. The Persians were a more powerful group than the Medes. Well, he has these three ribs that are in his mouth. The number probably is just to be taken as symbolically as a round number. That he's not content with one body, with one nation, but he's devouring many. He's going out and arising, devouring flesh, devouring the nations before him. If the three is to be taken literally, it's probably as reference to Babylon, Lydia, and Egypt, the three major nations that fell before the Medo-Persians. But the bear is commanded again to arise, devour much flesh. Where does that command come from? That comes from God. And so God is in control. God is the ruler of nations. And then verse 6, we have a third beast representing a third nation, another like a leopard. It says, "After this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard." Well, again, we can visualize a leopard or a panther, can't we? We know what that looks like. But again, it's not like any leopard that we know, because he says, "with four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it." So the third empire, the Macedonian Empire, the Grecian Empire, the Empire of Alexander the Great, represented here by a leopard, a panther, represented again in Nebuchadnezzar's dream by the belly and the thighs of bronze. But it has four wings on its back, two pairs of wings. It doesn't say these are eagle's wings like the lion, but just wings of a bird, wings of a more normal type bird. And it has four heads, and dominion was given to it. Who's this dominion given to it by? Well, once again, God. God is in charge of all of these things that are unfolding. That's the message. The leopard or panther is noted for its nimbleness, for its quick striking ability, its agility, its prowess. It doesn't have the strength of a lion, but in some ways it's a better hunter than a lion because of its quickness and its agility that it has. And again, we see that in Jeremiah and Hosea and Isaiah, Habakkuk. But it has these four wings of a bird on its back. That would show swiftness. It has that agility, not only of the leopard, but also of a bird. You know, a bird can just flit around from here to there very, very quickly. Sometimes it's hard to even see them as they move from place to place. Whereas an eagle, like the lion had, they're more of a soaring type animal, but they can't dart around. These are more the wings of a regular bird that gives it that quick ability to move from place to place. And so that would show the rapidity and the swiftness with which this nation makes its conquest. If you study the history of Alexander the Great and the conquest he had, they were very swift. In fact, he'll be depicted in the next chapter, chapter 8, as a male goat that comes from the west and its feet aren't even touching the ground, because it's moving with such swiftness. And then we have these four heads. Well, a couple of possibilities of what those might mean. The four successors of Alexander. Again, if you know the history there, Alexander died at a very young age, ironically in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. And as he died, as he was on his deathbed, he divided his kingdom actually among five generals, but one of those generals gave up his claim very quickly, and so really he had four that ended up over Greece, Western Asia, Egypt, and Persia. Others have said, no, these four heads are the four corners of the earth, from Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 6, just showing the extent of the kingdom. Again, that it's over all of the known world. But again, dominion was given to this kingdom. It's all taking place at God's direction. Just as in the other kingdoms, this kingdom is under the overruling providence of God. He's orchestrating all of these things. It can only conquer because God has given it the power to conquer. Indeed, God rules in the affairs of men. Again, we'll see more on this kingdom as we move into chapter 8. But really the focus here of these four beasts is on the fourth beast, verses 7 and 8. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth that devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the 10 horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. And so we have again this beast being described in verse 7. And notice it's introduced with a significant sobriety and solemnness. It says that this beast is terrifying, he's dreadful, it's exceedingly strong. Much stronger terms than used for any of these preceding beasts. And notice it's not compared to any known animal. Daniel doesn't say it's like a You know, this beast is evidently just something that there's not really anything Daniel could compare it to that we could understand what this beast is like. Its identity with the iron in the image in chapter 2 is unmistakable. We see that this beast had great power and the ability to destroy. It has great iron teeth, characteristic of rage and of destruction. It's very destructive. It says it devoured, it broke, it stamped with its feet. It's just tearing up everything around about it. Chapter 2, verse 40, again going back to that image, it says, "And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these." Saying the same thing, isn't it? Just in different words and different symbolism. Well, this beast represents that Roman Empire. That empire that the last of these great world empires, the empire into which Jesus is going to be born and do His ministry, and it's the empire that's going to hang Him on a cross. It's the empire under which the church is going to be established and have its beginning, its first few centuries before that kingdom is destroyed, that earthly kingdom, but not God's kingdom that He established. It destroys the beasts that are before it, these nations that were before. This beast had 10 horns. These 10 horns are kings. We know that from verse 24. "As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise. And another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones, and he shall put down 3 kings. And so it tells us what these are. Well, the age-old question is the 10 literal or 10 symbolic? Is he talking about 10 literal kings or 10 being a complete number? Again, those numbers are very important in this type of literature. How is he using it? If it's symbolic, then he's talking about a multiplicity of rulers, a definite totality of rulers. If it's literal, then it's a literal 10 kings. We'll talk more again about that in a moment. The horn, or horns, is symbolic of power. You think about an animal that has horns, maybe some of these rams with these big curly horns, and what do? You see them on the TV, you know, they back off there and they hit each other, and the power and the sound that comes from those hitting each other, those are symbolic of power. Deuteronomy 33 verse 17 says, "A firstborn bull, he has majesty, and his horns are the horns of a wild ox. With them he shall gore the peoples, all of them, to the ends of the earth. They are the 10,000s of Ephraim. They are the 1,000s of Manasseh." He's talking about the strength there that they have. The strength of a wild ox. They're going to gore people. They're going to push people with those horns to the ends of the earth. In 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 1, as Hannah comes and she's praying for a child, it says, "And Hannah prayed and said, My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord." What's she talking about? She's talking about her strength, her power that she has. It's exalted in the Lord. "My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation." In verse 10 of that chapter, it says, "The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken in pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed." Again, that's talking about the power, the authority of his anointed. Well, what does all this mean? Especially when we get to these horns and these 10 horns and one to come up after and so forth. Well, we're dealing with these different kingdoms. Now we're in the Roman Empire. Again, that's the same empire that is being dealt with in the first century. The same empire that's persecuting the church. that John is writing about as he writes in the book of Revelation. And so I think as you come to that fourth empire, then we have a lot of ties back over to Revelation. Turn over to Revelation 13. Revelation 13. We have there what we might call the sea beast. A beast that comes up out of the sea. It says, "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea." Well, that's the same place that this beast has rose from, isn't it? Here in the book of Daniel. All four of these beasts rose up from the sea. What? The sea of humanity. Of the peoples. Notice the beast here in Revelation 13 with 10 horns, 7 heads, with 10 diadems, crowns on its horns, and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. Well, those three animals are interesting, aren't they? Because those are the same three animals we just looked at in Daniel. This empire has some of the traits of all of those kingdoms that had been before it. The Roman Empire was very good about taking the best traits from those kingdoms before it and incorporating them into itself. It says, "And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority." The dragon in Revelation is Satan himself. Satan is giving to this great beast, the sea beast, his power, his throne, his authority. So his power is coming from Satan. Verse 3, "One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed this beast." So the earth is following after this beast. Verse 4, and they worshipped the beast, for he had given his authority, or they worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?" And so the people are worshipping the dragon, who is Satan. They're worshipping the beast. The Roman Empire. Verse 5, "And the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. Well, there's an interesting number. 42 months, that's 3.5 years. When we come later on here in chapter 7 in Daniel, we'll look at next week, Daniel talks about time, times, and half a time. 3.5. 42 months, 3.5. Probably, again, not talking about literal months or 3.5 literal years, but an incompleteness. 3.5 is half of 7. 7 is that complete number. And so it represents incompleteness. This beast, even though it's been given power and authority by Satan himself, is not going to be able to accomplish his desired purpose in the time that he's been given. God is going to limit his time. And so he's not going to be able to complete it. He's going to win some battles, but he's going to lose the war. He's not going to be able to overthrow God and God's people, because he's limited. If you drop down to verse 18 of that chapter, the very last verse, it says, "This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it's the number of a man. His number is 666. 666 is the number of absolute failure. We have 3.5, which is the number of incompleteness. And then 666, a number of absolute failure. 777 would be the number of absolute completion. And now we have number of absolute failure. It comes short on all three counts. This beast is not going to be able to do what he wants to do. What he is trying to do. What Satan is empowering him to do. And so this beast represents the civil persecuting power of the Roman Empire. And certainly they did that. In chapter 17, still in Revelation, we have another beast that is represented, a scarlet beast. We don't have time to go through and read that, but this would be the earth beast. We have a prostitute that is riding on this beast. And all kinds of blasphemies and so forth are being put forth. But this beast represents the religious persecuting power of the Roman Empire. And the two beasts work in concert with one another. Again, being empowered by Satan, the prostitute sitting on the beast is Rome itself. Because in verse 9 it says, "This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated." Well, the city of Rome is known as the city that sits on seven hills. And so he's talking about Rome itself as this woman, but she's riding on this beast. All of these things working in concert with one another. We'll see next week how that those beasts, both of these beasts, the sea beast and the scarlet beast, which is also called the false prophet, are thrown into a lake that burns with fire and brimstone. But notice again quickly, the kings of Rome, which seem to fit the ten horns and then one horn coming up after. In Revelation it talks about seven kings. But in Daniel it talks about ten, but this one that comes up after, rooting up three of the ones before. Well, you have the history of Rome. Of course, Rome has been growing and conquering for a good while, but Octavian was the first one to take the title of Augustus, or the revered one. He's the one that it's considered to, the Roman Empire is considered to be formerly established under. And so if you begin with Augustus, you have then Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero. Those were all of the house of Julius Caesar, the Julian house. They were all descendants of Julius Caesar. And then you have, notice, three kings that are really of no consequence. Galba, Otho, Vitalis, all ruling for very short periods of time. And then you have a new house that comes to reign, the Flavian house, Vespasian and Titus. Titus, remember, is the one that led the armies against Jerusalem in 70 AD. And he becomes emperor then in 79. But then you have an 11th, Domitian. And Domitian's a totally different character than all the ones before him. Because it was under Domitian that they began an empire-wide persecution of Christians. An empire-wide persecution of the church that he would be very relentless in. And the subsequent emperors behind him would continue on very ruthlessly in. You say, well, what about Nero? We hear a lot about Nero being a great persecutor, but Nero's persecution was pretty much limited to Rome and the immediate vicinity. If you were off in Jerusalem or somewhere, you didn't have to worry a whole lot about Nero. But with Domitian, now this persecution is going to be very widespread. And so a horn, a little horn, but it's speaking blasphemous things. It's very powerful in its persecution against the church. Well, as we move from verse 8 into verse 9, which is where Alan read earlier, the scene shifts from these beasts over to a heavenly courtroom with the Ancient of Days reigning. He's the one in charge. All that's taking place here on the earth with all of these kings and all of these beasts and all of these things is only happening as He allows it to happen. But He's setting up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. Lesson's yours. Is anyone here who needs to respond to the Lord's invitation this evening? That invitation is open. You'd let your need be known as we stand and sing.